Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Take a walk in somebody else's shoes with podcasts from the BBC World Service. Unmissable stories from around the globe. Search for the documentary Lives Less Ordinary and Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Are you ready for some magic?
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 14 hours GMT on Tuesday, the 2nd of January, these are our main stories. An incredible escape for 379 passengers as their Japan Airways jet collides with another plane at a Tokyo airport and then bursts into flames. Five people died on the other aircraft, which was a Coast Guard plane preparing to help with relief for the New Year's Day earthquake, which has killed at least 48 people. Fury in Somalia as Ethiopia strikes a port access deal which effectively recognises breakaway Somaliland. Also in this podcast, Women's World Cup winner Jenny Hermoso tells the court she did not consent to being kissed on the lips by the boss of Spanish football. And we hear about the 16-year-old World Championship dart sensation everyone is talking about.
When he turned up to play darts, they were saying, no, not him again. When he was 12, they were terrified of playing him because he was too good.
Luke Littler takes on Rob Cross in the semi-finals later today. We start in Japan, where all 379 passengers and crew have incredibly escaped with their lives after the Japan Airlines jet they were on collided with another plane on landing at Tokyo's Haneda Airport. Video footage of the accident shows the rear of the airliner trailing a fireball as it slows to a stop, which quickly engulfs the back half of the jet. The blaze then spread to the rest of the plane. Five of the six people aboard the other plane, a Coast Guard aircraft, were killed. They were on their way to help with rescue efforts after the earthquake that struck the Ishikawa Prefecture on New Year's Day. Our reporter Suranjana Tiwari is at the airport.
It's been 3 hours since the collision and firefighters have finally managed to control the blaze on that Japan Airlines aircraft. I can't say there's much left of the aircraft. It's completely charred and there is still one plume of smoke coming from it. There's about a dozen fire trucks around it continuing to monitor it. And it's really caused a lot of disruption here at Haneda Airport, Japan's busiest airport. The four runways are shut and no planes are coming in or going out. So many passengers stranded here. As you mentioned, five out of the six passengers on the smaller aircraft that the Japan Airlines plane collided with have unfortunately died. However, more than 370 passengers on the Japan Airlines flight did manage to escape, which is quite miraculous given the size of the blaze and the time it took to overwhelm the aircraft.
Yeah, that really is the story, isn't it? Because the pictures of that fire, initially half the aircraft engulfed with flames coming out of the window, then the entire thing. But it does seem extraordinary that everyone aboard that aircraft apparently got off safely.
That's right. I mean, we've seen some amateur video of chaos and confusion when they were trying to get off the plane naturally. But actually, when the plane was approaching the tarmac, it left a huge fireball behind it, which must have been the Coast Guard's plane. And the passenger plane was on fire when it landed. But that fire seemed to be quite isolated initially, and it seemed like it was going to get under control very quickly. But very quickly, in a very short space of time, it just engulfed the entire plane, and the fire trucks were just unable to control the blaze, and the entire fuselage was just stripped back with that fire.
And as I understand it, this is the first accident involving an Airbus A350.
Japan has a very strong safety record, especially when it comes to transport. And an expert actually told the BBC that it is credit to the crew that they managed to get the passengers off in such a short space of time because of training and stringent procedures. Japan's prime minister has said that this incident is going to be investigated very carefully and procedures are going to be put in place as a result of them. It's not clear what caused the collision. The Coast Guard plane was going to join rescue efforts for the earthquake that struck Japan just over 24 hours before this collision.
Surinjana Tiwari at that airport in Tokyo. Well, Japan is still trying to recover from the devastating effects of the earthquake on Monday. It has one of the world's most sophisticated early warning systems, which meant that thousands of people managed to leave the area safely. However, the race is now on to find people believed to be buried under the rubble of collapsed buildings. Rescue efforts are being hampered by damage to the roads. Our correspondent, Jean McKenzie, is on the ground on the Noto Peninsula, trying to travel towards the epicentre, and sent this report.
We've arrived at the small peninsula where the earthquake happened, and we are travelling towards the epicentre. And we keep coming across these areas of destruction where homes have been partially destroyed or some of them completely collapsed. Now, they tend to be these older homes that are made of wood, the houses that haven't been built to withstand these sort of earthquakes. We are trying to get closer to the epicentre, to a city where we know that at least a dozen people have been killed and many more are trapped in their homes because they have completely collapsed. But we're struggling to get there because we keep coming up against these roads that are just totally inaccessible. And we know that the rescue teams are also struggling to reach these worst affected areas where people are trapped in their homes. This has been a terrifying day and night for people, because the memories of that earthquake here in 2011 and the huge tsunami that followed that killed nearly 20,000 people, those memories are still so fresh in people's minds. And then you have the constant aftershocks that we've been having since yesterday afternoon. And the authorities are warning that there might be more major aftershocks in the days to come. What this earthquake has done is remind people here just how vulnerable they are to these disasters.
Jean McKenzie. South Korea's opposition leader Lee Jae-myung has been stabbed in the neck during a walkabout with journalists in the city of Busan. Mr. Lee was struck in the jugular vein, although the wound is not considered life-threatening. A man has been arrested in connection with the assault. The BBC's Rachel Lee in Seoul told me a little more about what happened.
He was there to visit a construction site in the port of Busan on Tuesday morning. When the stabbing happened, he was stabbed on the left side of his neck and was transferred to a hospital about 20 minutes after the attack. The attacker's weapon is reportedly to be about 20 to 30 centimeters long. Mr. Lee sustained a 1 centimeter laceration and received treatment while conscious, according to reports. Democratic Party spokesman said that the medical staff suspected injury to his jugular vein, which carries blood from the head to the heart. Now, the police stated that his wound is not life-threatening and currently Mr. Lee is hospitalized in Seoul National University Hospital, which is one of the biggest hospital in Seoul.
But no idea of motive.
Seoul's police bureau is currently under investigation in this matter. The attacker, what we know right now, is a man in his 60s, and he's being investigated as being accused of attempted murder, as he reportedly told the police that he did it to kill Mr. Lee. He alleged approached Mr. Lee asking for an autograph before suddenly lunging forward to stab him. The attacker, the police said, had purchased the weapon he used last year on the internet, but found no crime record of him.
Rachel Lee in Seoul. There's been another huge barrage of rockets sent over Russia's frontier and into Ukraine. The Ukrainians said 4 people were killed in the latest bombardment. These attacks came just hours after President Putin said his troops would be intensifying attacks. The mayor of Kyiv, Vitaly Klitschko, recorded a video in which he described the damage to one part of the capital.
Another brutal attack on our city, Solonyansky district. A large crater is behind me. A rocket fragment landed 10 meters away from the house. The apartment block is damaged. All residents are now evacuated. One elderly woman on the way to the hospital unfortunately died from her injuries. Everyone is being provided with medical assistance now. We're going to inspect this house now. After that, we will give more information regarding the next steps.
I asked the BBC's James Waterhouse in Kyiv about these latest attacks.
Ukrainians typically don't like seeing or hearing Vladimir Putin on TV, but his words were hard to ignore last night when he vowed to intensify attacks on what he called military sites in Ukraine. And sure enough, from about 2 a.m, the air raid sirens sounded. The air defences were working hard to repel what were initially Russian-launched drones. And then this morning, missiles then came in. There were fighter jets launched as well. It was an all-out aerial assault last night in a week where really things have ramped up in that regard. And where Mayor Klitschko was, we've just been to, I mean, that's quite a central neighbourhood. These strikes are becoming more and more central. The damage is enormous, and it is probable that Vladimir Putin is targeting military areas. We've seen evidence of that. But what is inescapable, undeniable, is the fact that it is civilian areas, spaces, homes, hospitals that are targeted or at best hit as well, not just in Kyiv overnight, but Kharkiv as well, which was also targeted. And I think the timing is significant as well, because it was feared Russia was stockpiling missiles. Those fears are being realised in the scale of the attacks we're seeing. But the air defence systems tested in this way rely on Western support to be replenished in the long term. And the last US-approved package has arrived. No more is scheduled to arrive for now. So it's a critical time.
And a furious response from President Zelensky.
Yeah, President Zelensky has, again, sort of condemned these attacks. And if you look at sort of the recent messaging coming from him, he is looking inward now. He is looking at trying to make Ukraine more self-sufficient in the face of this uncertain forecast, if you like, of future Western support. He's trying to boost military development. He's trying to meet drone manufacturing targets. But the scenes we are seeing now in Kyiv, I certainly hadn't seen since the first days and weeks of the initial full-scale invasion. The aim for Russia is to lessen people's desire to fight. What it does do is certainly makes people angry.
James Waterhouse in Kyiv. Next to an escalating diplomatic dispute between Ethiopia and Somalia. It centres on the breakaway territory of Somaliland, which is not recognised internationally as an independent state, but as part of Somalia. On Monday, Ethiopia said it was signing an agreement with Somaliland to use one of its ports, a move that could enable landlocked Ethiopia to gain access to the sea. That's prompted an angry reaction from the Somali government, which today said it was withdrawing its ambassador to Ethiopia. Somalia's Prime Minister, Hamza Abdi Barre, promised to protect the country's borders.
I want to urge the Somali people to calm down. I want to assure them we are committed to defending our country. No part of our land, our sea and our air can be violated, and we will defend it in every legal way. And I am sure that with the help of our people, whether they are in the north or in the south, we are able to defend our country.
Our correspondent Kalkadan Yibaltal is in Addis Ababa.
The details are still sketchy, but the Ethiopian authorities have said that they have signed this deal that would allow them to have access to the Red Sea, but they haven't said much. And most of the detail that we're having is coming from the Somaliland side. The officials in Somaliland said that Ethiopia will have 20 kilometers of coastal lines on the Red Sea, where it will build a military base, use it as such for 50 years, while Ethiopia in exchange will recognize Somaliland as a sovereign state.
Kalkadan Yibaltal. Now to Portugal, to remote, off-the-grid southern Portugal. Former BBC correspondent Alastair Leithhead and his wife Anna have given up their globe-trotting careers in journalism and diplomacy to set themselves a new challenge, to create a home off-the-grid deep in rural Alentejo in Portugal. They're exploring what goes into creating a small sustainable hotel when you need to generate your own power and extract and purify your own water. And despite no prior experience, he's giving it a try.
My previous career was as a foreign correspondent for the BBC. Now myself and my wife Anna are living here in Portugal and faced with quite a different challenge. It's a crucial point in our construction, and our water consultant, Rui, is on site explaining to the builder why we need three different types of water pipes going into each of our three new buildings, one for the toilet, the shower, and for drinking water. Because the less treatment we do, the less power we use and the less waste there is.
So on this drawing, I've got everything down because I was assuming that we had it like this.
It's not the traditional way of doing things here, but relying on mineral-rich boreholes and rainwater is the only way to guarantee all the water we need.
So my name is Rui Faria, and for the last 20 years I've been working with independent systems for water treatment, wastewater treatment. Off-grid is the biggest part of it. And in some cases, like your project here, you have neither treated water, neither public sewage. So to be off-grid here in a project like this, we have to be self-supported in having your water treated and your wastewater also treated.
As a regular consumer, water is just something that comes out of the tap. And that's what
that's my wife, Anna. To move here, we both gave up our jobs, which had nothing to do with water. But
this is actually the most central part for our living here. And it's been really, really useful. It's been a journey of learning how much water we actually consume versus how much water do we actually need to consume and how can we actually be sustainable about it in our daily lives. Because it's central to our work, it's central to our project, and we really need it.
Problems with salt and with minerals and iron, and that's pretty much, we've got all of it, haven't we?
Indeed, yeah.
And so just, quite a challenge.
And indeed, and just to make the recipe complete, you also have lots of calcium in the water, so the water is very hard. And we only realize how difficult it is when we have to face it that way.
Because for us, it's the cost of the equipment to start with, for the filtering iron and reverse osmosis for salt. Then it's the waste, which is what maybe even half is wasted when it goes through the system. And as you say, dealing with waste on the top of a hill, where does it all go? And because we're off-grid, we haven't got the power to do all this stuff whenever it wants to do it. Everything we're doing is based around trying to only run pumps when we want them to, which is when the sun's shining.
With this, we can use the unfiltered water to flush the toilets, because nobody is going to drink or take water out of the toilet for any other reason.
That's not the kind of guest we're looking to attract.
Exactly.
We've had a lot of sleepless nights getting to this point, most of them about water, but also whether we'd get a loan from the tourism authority, permissions, finding a builder, then inflation. Three buildings and an infinity pool with wine cellar are now built here on the hill. Windows and the polished concrete floors are next. Project managing construction is always difficult, but even harder when the whole water and electrical infrastructure has to be installed. Well, it's been a real challenge getting our heads around this, but we have a couple of things we keep telling ourselves. One of them is every day is a school day. And what's the other one, love?
If this was easy, everyone would do it.
It's not that easy, is it?
It's really hard.
Final question, how's the budget looking?
We're almost at budget, but a bit over.
Bit over.
Alistair and Anna Leithhead, and you can find out how they're doing from Business Daily, wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up in the Global News podcast, the colossal fossil, not T-Rex, but C-Rex.
Just to describe it, I mean, think about a crocodile, but a crocodile on steroids. It's got an elongated snout, absolutely enormous jaws.
Unmissable stories from around the globe.
If there's a war or any emergency happening to Taiwan, then, you know, I would be also part of it.
The documentary. Gripping storytelling from the BBC World Service.
This has been our life since childhood. Every year, wars and difficult events.
The documentary.
It's a vantage point from which to survey a new horizon.
Search for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
We carry the world in our pockets. For breaking news you can trust and the stories that shape us, choose Canada's News app. Reporting from the scene onto your screens. When you want, where you want. Download the free CBC News app today.
The Hamas-run health ministry in Gaza says more than 22,000 Palestinians have now been killed since the start of Israel's military campaign. The conflict between Israel and Hamas is poised to enter a new phase, with the Israeli military announcing a withdrawal of some of its forces from Gaza this month. So how's that being viewed in Washington? My colleague Martha Carney has been talking to one of the most respected military figures in the United States, General David Petraeus, who served in Afghanistan and Iraq and was director of the CIA.
Well, it depends which part of the United States. There are certain parts in the administration, of course, that have been urging for Israel to refine what it's doing in Gaza. But there will be others, and I would be among them, who will ask, how will this affect Israel's ability to accomplish its overriding mission, which is, of course, to destroy Hamas, dismantle the political wing of Hamas, and to rescue all of the Israeli and other hostages that Hamas holds. And for that, Israel still has to clear and hold all of Gaza. How will this latest decision affect Israel's ability to carry that mission out? And what is the vision for the Palestinian people in Gaza once Hamas has been destroyed and the Hamas political wing has been disassembled?
Although you'll have heard the arguments that this mission by Israel to try to destroy Hamas is coming at too high a price because of the numbers of civilian casualties, and also in the end might be counterproductive because it's radicalizing future generations who may go on to join Hamas fighters.
It's a very legitimate concern. We always had a sign on the command posts where I was privileged to command, for example, during the surge in Iraq or the surge in Afghanistan, that asked a question that was always staring at us. Will this operation take more bad guys off the street than it creates by its conduct? And if the answer to that is no, you have to rescope the operation. You have to determine how you can get to yes. And certainly there have been a number of instances, I think, so far where, in hindsight at least, the answer to that question was no.
General David Petraeus speaking to my colleague Martha Carney. The American rock band Green Day have often been outspoken about Donald Trump. Despite his numerous legal woes, the former president is leading the race to represent the Republicans in this year's US election, which might be why the band used a New Year's Eve TV performance to change the lyrics of one of their best-known songs, American Idiot, as Paddy McGuire reports.
Released in 2004 on the album of the same name, which has sold 12 million copies worldwide, don't wanna be an American idiot. The song American Idiot was originally written to criticise the policies of the then President George W. Bush, his response to the terror attacks of 9/11, and the American media. This isn't the first time the band has altered the lyrics of the song to have a dig at the right. But when Green Day took to the stage on the ABC show Dick Clark's New Year's Rockin' Eve with Ryan Seacrest, the frontman Billy Joe Armstrong used the opportunity to swap the words from this, I'm not a part of a redneck agenda, I'm not part of a redneck agenda, to this, I'm not a part of a MAGA agenda, I'm not part of the MAGA agenda. Green Day has had a go at Donald Trump and his supporters before. This is what they had to say when they played at the American Music Awards in 2016, the year he was elected president, and coined the phrase Make America Great Again, or MAGA. After this latest jab, Trump fans quickly hit back on social media. Some called Green Day irrelevant and lame. Others, perhaps not aware of the band being so politically outspoken, accused them of selling out. Green Day may turn out to be the least of Donald Trump's concerns. Maine recently became the second US state to disqualify him from contesting the Republican primaries, citing a constitutional insurrection clause because of his actions leading up to the Capitol riot in 2021. How that, along with the criminal charges he faces over his attempt to overturn his defeat at the last elections, plays out remains to be seen.
Paddy McGuire. The Spanish football player Jenny Hermoso has appeared in court in Madrid as part of an investigation into Luis Rubiales, the former president of Spain's Football Federation. Mr. Rubiales could face trial for sexual assault for kissing Ms. Hermoso on the lips after the Spanish women's team won the World Cup in August. Guy Hedgeco reports from Madrid.
In her court appearance, Jenny Hermoso is reported to have repeated her assertion that when Mr. Rubiales kissed her, he did so without her consent, a claim he contests. This was the final hearing in this probe, which will decide whether Mr. Rubiales goes on trial for sexual assault. The controversy overshadowed the Spanish team's World Cup win and led to a major shake-up within the Football Federation. It also triggered a broader movement against sexism in other areas of Spanish society.
Guy Hedgeco. Now, we all love an underdog story, and this is one everyone is talking about here in the UK. He's known as Luke the Nuke Littler, with plenty of justification. The 16-year-old, in his first ever World Darts Championship, is on his way to the semi-finals after beating a player three times his age. Luke says, "It's crazy watching myself at 18 months or 2 years old in a nappy, but it has all paid off."
Yeah.
You're going to get me a 180?
Yeah.
Go on then.
On Monday, Luke sent fans wild at Alexandra Palace in London before speaking to reporters about his chances of winning the whole tournament.
There is no sign of this teenage dream coming to an end.
Unbelievable. Obviously, I know I've got the ability to go all the way, but if it's not to be tomorrow night, then it's not to be. But whatever Luke Little turns up, then it is what it is.
Carl Holden is the co-founder of the St Helens Darts Academy, where Luke honed his skills.
He was only 9 years of age when they first came to the Darts Academy.
Could you tell he was so talented at that young age?
Pretty quickly, he was a bit better than all the kids under 10, shall we say. Then, obviously, he developed, went into the next section, then he went up to the under-14s elite, and within a year, he actually was playing in the under-21s at age of just before his 11th birthday, which is something we'd never witnessed before. So he's always been something different, yeah.
Very different, and it must have been very strange for the older kids having this tiny 11-year-old coming up against them. A bit humiliating.
We was telling them, look at the bigger picture, enter the tournaments, you know, like in the pubs or clubs, whatever. Any tournament you can for get more experience. It was just great people in my town. When he turned up to play darts, they were saying, no, not him again. When he was 12, they was terrified of playing him because he was too good. And it's pretty funny.
And it's not just, though, being such a good player, is it? There's something about his coolness, isn't there, under pressure?
Yeah, darts is about pressure. I mean, I was watching Rob Cross yesterday in that play, and it looked like he was going to lose 5-0, and then he ends up winning 5-4. And right at the end, you could see both players snatching and pulling, and it's that sheer pressure. When you're under pressure, it's much harder to play on that stage. But Luke's took it really well at the moment. He's not been under any serious pressure. I think he will be with Rob Cross. He's one of the best players in the world. This is his biggest task, yeah. But again, if he plays his A game, he's got a really good chance to beat Rob.
And he really seems to enjoy the atmosphere and the crowds, doesn't he? He turned at one point and say, should I try to win the leg with the bullseye?
Yeah, he's done that a few times. I mean, for age 16, not many get in that position, but he loves it, you know. He's an entertainer as well, you know. Age of 16, his last few years, he's developed that path in his game, you know, where he's done crazy things, and I've seen him on the checkout there, and he's looked at the score, and he'll go 5 treble 18s, double 16, and he works it out. He's very clever on that stage and on the dartboard.
How do you rate his chances to win the semi-final, even the championship?
He's got the ability to do it. Nobody else has got his ability at that age. No, I don't think anybody under the age of 21's got the ability to reach the semi-finals. So I think he's about 50-50 to win it, to be honest with you. We'll find out tonight.
And that is incredible odds given his age. Carl Holden there speaking to Martha Carney. To news of a giant sea predator so large that it's been called the Sea Rex, an underwater version of T-Rex. The skull of this prehistoric creature was recently unearthed on the south coast of England. Today, it's gone on display for the public for the first time. Our science editor, Rebecca Morell, is at the museum in Dorset in southwest England and told us more.
This is a colossal fossil. It's the skull of a sea creature called a pliosaur. It is 2 metres long, absolutely enormous. And you can see its huge jaws. I mean, it's a bit like a crocodile on steroids, and they are packed with dozens of these razor-sharp teeth. This would have been a killing machine. It would have eaten anything it got its jaws into and probably killed it off with a single bite. Now, it lived 150 million years ago, about the same time that dinosaurs were roaming the land. This thing would have been terrorizing the ocean. And it is a beautifully preserved fossil. So the snout of it, the tip of its nose, was found by a fossil enthusiast who was walking along Kimmeridge Bay in Dorset, and he discovered that. And then he told Steve Etchis, whose museum this is now in, about it, who then realised that the rest of its skull, the rest of this enormous skull, was in a cliff. So the team excavated it, dangling from ropes halfway down a crumbling cliff face to get this thing out. Then it took about 10 months to actually prepare it, to get rid of all the clay and dirt around it, until finally this beautiful fossil emerged. Now, it is such a fantastically preserved specimen, and scientists think it's also perhaps a species that's new to science too, but there might be a bit more of this beast to come. Because the team thinks the rest of its body, which is about another 10 metres, so this thing would have been the size of a double-decker bus, they think it may still be buried in the cliffs here.
And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Pat Sissons, and the producer was Tracy Gordon. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.